ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us, told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a sliding doors moment in global history.
Two great powers sit face to face in Beijing. But what will emerge from the Xi-Trump summit?
Do the presidents choose a path to greater stability or ratchet up the economic and political tension?
And can the chaos agent keep a lid on the fireworks? I'm Latika Burke.
I'm Kylie Morris. And this episode we ask, what's the best the world can hope for when Donald Trump meets Xi Jinping?
Kylie, it's the summit of all summit seasons. Are you excited? Have you been looking forward to this one?
Looking forward to would be overstating it, but I do think it's really significant, right? There is so much going on globally, and these two men hold so much power between the two of them. When they walk into that room, into the East Court of the Great Hall of the People on Tiananmen Square, it's not the first time they've met, but they meet at a critical moment, I think. I mean, this is the first visit by Donald Trump back to Beijing since November 2017. So that was back in his first term when he wasn't embroiled in a Middle Eastern war with Iran. You know, he didn't have midterm elections on his doorstep and his polls weren't cratering in the way they are now. I mean, you could say that not much good has happened between the two superpowers since that initial meeting. I mean, their relationship is really marred now by pretty regular disagreement. At the same time, pushing against all of that, I've covered a few summits in my time, as you have too, Latika. I was at the Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump meeting in Singapore, which really didn't achieve much at all apart from the photo opportunity. So,
and did you get to see the president and the supreme leader in the flesh? What was the pageantry of the media? Because we know Donald Trump loves the media to be the audience there. Did you get much of a ringside seat?
Well, that we were held back slightly. I mean, it was for security reasons, obviously. There was massive security. So we were taken out to, it was on Sentosa Island, and the two of them walked across the stage for the cameras and shook hands, and we were kind of back in the nosebleed seats watching on. Later on, though, the president emerged from that meeting and he held a typically rambling, long-form press conference where he took questions on all kinds of things and just riffed, but there was no sense of history in the room. There was no sense that the world just changed. So, you know, I understand sometimes these moments can feel promising and feel significant, but then they don't achieve very much. In this case, I feel like it will be very different simply because of the amount of power that these two men hold. Whatever happens in that room is significant.
In many ways, I feel like this is what we have been waiting for with the Trump presidency because, Kylie, there's been a lot of talk about whether we see a G2 emerge out of this, which would essentially mean China and the United States sitting down, carving up spheres of influence, both agreeing, look, you don't interfere here, we won't interfere there. And by the way, we've got some competition underway on things like AI. And here's what's non-negotiable. Now, where would that leave Taiwan, really, in the midst of all that is the big, big question. And I'm not sure we know the answers to that going in. In fact, I'm less clear and less certain the longer the Trump presidency 2.0 continues, because the first Trump presidency on China was quite hawkish. It had some very clear principled guidelines, I felt, and some tracks that you could navigate the groove which he was sliding in. This time, absolutely no way.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should mention that Donald Trump on his way to Beijing on the flight tried a bit of misdirection where he said to reporters on the flight, we have a lot of things to discuss. I wouldn't say Iran is one of them because we have Iran very much under control. Now, of course, that will not be President Xi's view. China isn't a close ally.
I'm hearing a Shaw Jan Brady Bunch meme in my head here.
Yeah, look, there will be no tying a bow on Iran in these conversations. And, you know, that feels like wishful thinking to me from Donald Trump. I should just say, of course, Hamish and Waleed spoke to Kirsty Needham. She's an ex-Beijing correspondent now with the AFP on a previous episode about this summit. She brought a whole different view. Today, though, we're going to Zhongyuan Zoe Liu. She's an expert on the Chinese economy and on foreign policy. She's a senior fellow for China Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in the US. She's got an undergraduate degree from Shandong University and a PhD from Johns Hopkins University. And her latest book is Sovereign Funds, How the Communist Party of China Finances Its Global Ambitions. Let's hear that conversation now.
Zoe, welcome to Global Roaming. So as we go to air, President Trump and President Xi are about to greet one another ahead of their bilateral meeting and the state banquet tonight. They have done all of this before in Beijing 9 years ago, more recently in South Korea. So why this year? Why now is there so much more focus about what happens in the next 48 hours?
Yeah, first of all, Latika and Kylie, thank you very much for inviting me on your show. Why now? I just say there is a confluence of several factors, right? The most important part is what the two presidents want from each other. Now, President Trump is running on a much shorter political clock compared with President Xi Jinping, whose political clock, or for that matter, the Communist Party of China, the political clock could be much longer, seemingly indefinite. Now, for President Trump, he's up for midterm. The Republican Party in general is up for midterm election. And his economic message so far has been complicated. And President Trump, his own approval rating has been record low. A lot of these economic bad numbers has been a product of, honestly speaking, self-inflicted wound from tariff to the attack on Iran and rising energy prices. So obviously, President Trump wants this meeting to yield at least some easy wins, such as visible Chinese support to de-escalate the tension in the Middle East, especially hoping that China may exert some leverage against Iran. And then secondly, President Trump probably also want some big Chinese commitment to buy the so-called 3Bs, beef, Boeing, airplanes, and soybeans. And then last but not least, perhaps there are also some conversations along the lines of AI governance, as well as the so-called Board of Trade as a framework to or dialogue for U.S.-China communication to continue in non-sensitive issues. But on this Board of Trade issue, the Chinese readouts so far has no mentioning of it. So those are what Trump would want from this meeting. But to very quickly close the loop, what China may want from it, I think as long as this summit happens for China, this is a win. And the last time a sitting U.S. president going to China for a state visit was 2017. That was the first Trump administration. So in a way, this is almost like a homecoming positive for China, because the two sides are very much on different footing. Chinese policymakers have a lot of reason to believe that now they are on a much stronger footing compared with before. And more importantly, since 2017 to now, almost a decade, U.S.-China relationship has been continuing on a downward trend. The relationship has deteriorated. So the idea is that if the summit happened and this very first summit could potentially kick off series of other, not just head of state meeting, but also working level meetings, so that the two sides can have a broader strategic framework to stabilize the relationship.
Do we have any clue about how these two interact personally? Trump speaks very favorably about Xi, almost warmly, compared to maybe some of his other Democratic counterparts that he seems to have less time for. What do we know about how Xi views Trump?
Right. For President Xi Jinping, he's very different. You know, like as a Chinese president and the top leader of China's ruling political party, he governs as a emperor. His job is not to engage in any mundane and emotional expressions. Instead, he governs with a heavy dose of aloof. He doesn't really show his emotion to any foreign leaders. So hence, a lot of speculations, you know, to what extent he is, his best friend is President Putin, and to what extent he and President Trump at this time may or may not have a hug, and who is going to have a more dominant handshake. Now, a lot of speculations, and the fact that we are speculating about it is because he's not the only Chinese president like this, probably other than former Chinese president Jiang Zemin. Other than him, other Chinese president since Jiang Zemin has been very much about not showing your emotion. So I think that they are actually good poker players, because they are very good with this poker face, right?
It's not really how we think of Donald Trump, is it? I mean, he is anything but aloof, right? He's this rambunctious kind of character. I don't think you'd ever have to guess what he's feeling.
Oh, yeah, very much so. But I'd say President Trump, compared with President Trump, President Xi Jinping, it's very important for him to show stability and consistency. And that is very different from President Trump, who can say one thing this minute and then suddenly change his mind.
So you've said that finally President Xi has got the United States he's always wanted, that right now Washington, to quote from your article, is less confident in its global purpose, less committed to the rules-based order, and more willing to wield power in ways that unsettle markets, institutions and allies, and that its global authority and credibility are wearing away. But the flip side to that is the instability that accompanies that, if we accept it. So the uncertainty of the Trump leadership, that is in fact a problem for Beijing, isn't it?
Exactly, Kylie. You are exactly right. I've made this argument that President Xi Jinping, or for that matter, the Communist Party of China, is getting the America that they always wanted, which is relatively weaker and less capable, less credible to rally around allies to contain China. And I guess I think, you know, Australia is one good example. And Australia is one good example in the sense that it's a security partner, intelligence partner of the United States, ally, and then at the same time, economically, very much interdependent with China. So from that point of view, I'd say the instability that this less predictable version of America since President Trump took office in 2017. This version of America not just upset American allies, it is also not a good news for China. The reason is because the Chinese economy fundamentally so far, 20% of the economy is export driven, which basically means China needs a stable and sustained global environment and global economy to absorb China's massive industrial capacity. And China itself is about 30% of global manufacturing capacity. And domestically, there has been a chronic weak domestic household consumption. That basically means it needs the rest of the world to take Chinese goods. And if instability, either because of war or the undermining of global institutions or economic recession, lead to a prolonged global economic downturn, that is ultimately hurting the Chinese economy. And a weakened Chinese economic growth trajectory is a destabilizing factor for the Communist Party's foundation to govern.
You're with me, Latika Burke, and Kylie Morris, listening to Global Roaming. We're talking to Zhongyuan Zoe Liu, an expert on the Chinese economy and foreign policy, and we're discussing the Trump and Xi summit in Beijing.
Zoe, is there a possibility that we're kind of getting this all wrong by looking at it through a traditional geopolitical lens, that actually what matters most here, you could argue, is that these are two dominant AI powers whose reach lies, of course, well beyond their borders. When you look at who Donald Trump is taking with him to Beijing, you know, there are AI builders in the group, not only Elon Musk, but Cristiano Amon from Qualcomm is going to be there. They're a pioneer in edge AI. Sanjay Mehrotra is there too, from Micron. So how significant is the way this meeting has the potential to impact the AI Cold War that's going on between these two superpowers?
AI is fundamentally integrated into the two powers' search for global dominance. It doesn't matter whether we are afraid of an AI bubble because of overinvestment. The stake is so high that the risk is that we do not want to risk losing global dominance because we didn't invest enough today. And from that point of view, I'd say we are fundamentally running a different race. The two countries are running different race. China is running the AI race for application. And in fact, when China started its AI Plus action plan, it was predating Trump's global tech campaign against Huawei. So one way or another, independent of America's tech containment against China, the regime, the party, the policymakers have already committed that this is a technology of the future that they cannot risk losing the dominance. So from that point of view, I'd say, is this a tech cold war? Yes, in the sense that only US, China now are capable of building their own infrastructure that could potentially be not integrating with each other. But then at the same time, if you think about China already developed, made the commitment independent of America's tech containment, we can make a valid argument to thinking that this is actually China's own commitment to its so-called self-sufficiency as well as technological dominance going forward.
And Zoe, finally on Taiwan, what is your sense? Will they even talk about it? And who walks away with the upper hand?
Oh, Latika, that is a big question. The bottom line for China is that they will orchestrate the meeting and they would also carefully draft the readout carefully such that they do not give the wrong image that President Xi Jinping and President Trump did some sort of a grand bargain and Taiwan is a bargaining chip. Taiwan is something for exchange or Taiwan can be a deal to be made. The reason is that China has always considered Taiwan as its own domestic affairs and it has always stated repeatedly that it opposes any third-party interference. So if Taiwan in any way was presented as a deal to be made, that basically means China violated its own commitment with regard to Taiwan. So I'd say the language wouldn't be, we did this in exchange for America's a changing of language to explicitly oppose Taiwan independent, right? But I do think there will be language about the two sides emphasize the stability in across Taiwan Street. The two sides re-emphasized the importance of not accidentally walking into a war, meant the importance of maintaining stability in the Indo-Pacific region. There will not be any explicit language talking about, okay, so now Trump agreed to oppose Taiwan independent. And by the way, we also need to define what independence really means. So I don't expect any explicit language change there. And the reason is because China would carefully make sure that Taiwan is not something that any third party, including the United States, can step in and make a deal.
Do you see a sense of a G2 emerging out of this?
President Trump certainly talking about it. I don't think there is G2. The reason is because, you know, China always tries very hard to preserve its identity of being a member of the global South, right? But more importantly, China itself, there are many different phases. If you look at first-tier cities, that's one China. If you look at the western part of China, that's a very different China. So for China itself, I don't think China is ready to step into a bigger global role. And in fact, take a look at how China behave and its reaction in its so-called mediation role, carefully crafted mediator role in the war in Iran. It goes to show China is very careful. It does not want to take any additional responsibilities that it has neither the military capacity to maintain nor the political or monetary resource to deliver. So no J2.
Zoe, there was so much in that conversation, but it really is a fantastic guide to what might emerge from the summit. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me.
That was Zhong Juan, Zoe Liu, expert on the Chinese economy and foreign policy, senior fellow for China Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States. Kylie, I was very fascinated by her answer to that final question there about China not wanting to be a G2. Sometimes I think maybe, and I'm a bit guilty of this here, I think, maybe we project a bit too much onto China's ambitions and intentions than is really there, because that resonated very, very strongly with the conversation that Geraldine and I had with Rana Mitter, who was saying a lot of the same stuff. China, look, doesn't seek this global role. They don't want to be the upholder of any global norms as much as they talk about it and fashion themselves as the beacons of stability in a chaotic world. When it comes to the rub, they don't want to be out there policing the waterways.
Yeah, exactly. I think her answer on Taiwan too was very interesting. This idea that China doesn't necessarily want this to be worked over with the Americans, right? They don't want an official statement at the end of the meeting that allows any room for the US to define what China's policy is on Taiwan. It's not really up for discussion. Now, of course, one would expect that it is from the American perspective, right? For all kinds of strategic and other reasons, economic reasons particularly, they do want some assurances from China on Taiwan. But there's
well, and vice versa, Kylie. I mean, China would certainly want assurances from the United States on selling or not of the arms to Taiwan, let's be honest. So I think they're kind of keen for statements on Taiwan when and around what suits them.
But I guess they don't want to debate about the political future of Taiwan, because they've already settled that. That's not really
their internal affairs.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's not really up for discussion. I mean, I love the kind of the personal analysis of Zoe about the two men, you know, that going into the room. You know, Donald Trump is the one who is on the shorter political clock, I think was how she described it. You know,
yeah,
he is under all
too.
Kinds of pressure that certainly President Xi is not. But also she said, you know, that when it came to Xi himself, you know, he does a very good poker face. You know, he is a difficult person to read deliberately. And no doubt, you know, President Trump, as the master deal maker that he characterizes himself, will have insights, one imagines, into who President Xi is. But a lot of the work, of course, will have been done ahead of these two men meeting, right? There have been conversations between Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary,
yes,
and his equivalent in China to try and work out what might be possible on the trade front. So it is significant that the meeting is happening. And it is significant how these two men in the room manage one another and manage themselves. But there are unlikely to be kind of brand new announcements coming out of this.
You know, what I think really zooming out of all of this, Kylie, is so fascinating is kind of back to where we began this episode. At the start of the presidency, I think the US-China relationship, great power competition, was it. That was the defining chart of the world as we know it. But now so much has happened in between that I'm not sure that this feels as significant as a moment as it really is.
Yeah. No, I think it's right. I mean, I think that's the thing. When there's so much going on, everything is diluted, right? So you can't hold in your mind one singular thing that is many degrees more significant than something else, because everything is interconnected and changing all the time. I mean, I think Zoe's way of characterizing it, that this is the most important bilateral relationship in the world, I think that is true, and I would agree with that.
True.
And I think that's what makes this so significant. But yeah, it was great to hear from her. She has such an insight into the way that the Chinese government is approaching this, into the way that the finance flows operate around, both from within and outside China. And of course, that is something that China is keeping an eye on. I liked how she said that, you know, China feels like it's learned the game, right? That it learned to play the global economic game, even though they thought that the rules were unfair, that there were double standards, that they learned how to play it. But now the rules have changed, and that really challenges the stability that they're seeking. So, yeah, I'll have to – I want to go back already and listen to her again, actually, because I think there was a lot in that.
Yes, a lot of wisdom indeed. Share your wisdom, thoughts, whatever, with us. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. We love all your emails, good, bad, criticisms, suggestions. Keep them coming in, please. Thanks to our producer, Jessie Kay. It's Hamish and Geraldine back tomorrow. Kylie, do you know what they're talking about?
Look, I'm a little bit alarmed because I can't quite believe it. They've gazumped us, Latika,
now I'm alert.
On Eurovision.
Alert and alarmed.
On Eurovision. When we are the obvious pairing to talk about Eurovision, we've been robbed because they are talking to a brilliant Eurovision historian about the clash this year in Vienna. Between, I guess, real politic and, you know, music of the Eurovision style that never met an auto tuner it didn't like.
Okay, this is giving peak global roaming, Kylie. Peak global roaming.
I think it's going to be great. I mean, I am jealous. I'll be listening and, of course, watching in Vienna.
Are they wearing costumes? Do we know?
What, Jerry and Hamish?
Yeah.
Well, I think we need
I feel like if you get to talk about Eurovision on global roaming, you have to wear the costume.
There needs to be polyester in the room. Is that what you're saying?
And sequins.
Thanks, Latika. Have a good weekend.
See you, Kylie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.